Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by audible.co.uk. Download one title each month, plus unlimited listening to thousands of Audible originals, podcasts, and audiobooks. Just click on the Audible banner at www.tre.radio.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. We start by looking at the bestseller lists on Amazon.co.uk and the Sunday Times, the oldest and most influential book sales chart in the UK. Then we'll be catching up with Guy Lloyd, the international sales manager at Penguin Random House. He joins us once a month to talk all things books. This month, he's talking about Penguin's 90th anniversary, being this year, Jane Austen's 250th anniversary celebrations, Saucy Books in Notting Hill, who only sell romance books, and Bradley Wiggins' autobiography. We're also chatting to Caroline James, the celebrated author of later life fiction, with her vibrant storytelling stemming from her colourful career. She used to own a lively pub, then a charming country house hotel. As a media agent, she worked closely with celebrity chefs, giving her an insider's perspective on the glitz, glamour and grit of the culinary world. In her latest novel, The Cruise Club, you can set sail on the Diamond Star for sunshine, romance and just a little bit of mischief. And we're joined by Alice Fitzpatrick, who has contributed short stories to literary magazines and anthologies and has recently retired from teaching in order to devote herself to writing full time. Her summer spent with her Welsh family in Pembrokeshire inspired the creation of Meredith Island. The first book set there in the series is A Dark Death. That's just the first hour. In the second hour, we're chatting to Imogen Edwards-Jones, Menna van Praagh, and Virginia Evans.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Depends in my hand.
Good evening. Welcome to The Book Show. As always, we start by looking at the Sunday Times bestseller list, the oldest and most influential book sales chart in the UK, and the one that every author wants to be on. This chart is the most accurate and comprehensive estimation of book sales in the country. Starting with general hardbacks, just three new entries from last week. At number one, The Let Them Theory by Mel Robbins. Number two, Jess and Norma by Jessica Ashquith and Norma Burton. Number three, I can't say the word. They keep writing books with rude words in the title. I will say W. Anchornomics. I'm sure you can work that out, by James Schoffel and Charles Firth. Strategies to navigate the struggles of the modern working world. Number four, Remember When by Fiona Phillips. Number five, The Greatest Story Ever Told by Bear Grylls. Number six, The Idaho Murders by James Patterson and Vicky Ward. Number seven, another new entry called The Power of You by Michelle Knight Waite. Seven steps to finding the right techniques for you to manifest the life you want. The other new entry is at 8, To the Sea by Train by Andrew Martin, a tribute to seaside holidays shaped by the golden age of rail travel. Number 9, Don't Believe Everything You Think by Joseph Newgen. And number 10 is A River Alive by Robert McFarlane. Fiction hardbacks, again, 3 new entries from last week, including number 1, The Fallen and The Kiss of Dusk by Carissa Broadbent. Asar and Mish seek the power of a god. This is the sequel to The Songbird and The Heart of Stone. Number 2 is also a new entry. It's called A Theory of Dreaming by Ava Reed, the aftermath of Effie and Preston's discovery. This is a sequel to A Study in Drowning. And number 3 is the other new entry, called The Artist by Lucy Steeds. A young journalist's curiosity grows when probing the life of a reclusive painter. Number 4 is Not Quite Dead Yet by Holly Jackson. Number 5, Don't Let Him In by Lisa Jewell. Number 6, A Bury Our Bones in the Midnight Soil by V.E. Schwab. Number 7, The Names by Florence Knapp. Number 8 is Atmosphere by Taylor Jenkins Reid. Number 9, The Scene of the Crime by Linda LaPlante. And number 10 is Onyx Storm by Rebecca Yarros. Moving on to Amazon.co.uk, the top 10 bestsellers for this week. Still at number 1 is Entitled, The Rise and Fall of the House of York by Andrew Lowney. Number 2, The Housemaid by Freda McFadden. Number 3 is The Impossible Fortune, that's book 5 in the Thursday Murder Club series by Richard Osman. Number 4, The Housemaid's Secret by Freda McFadden. Number 5, The Let Them Theory by Mel Robbins. Number 6, Cozy Corner, a calm and comforting colouring book for all ages by Coco Wyo. Number 7, The Housemaid is Watching by Freda McFadden. Number 8, The Surrogate Mother by Freda McFadden. She's doing amazing, isn't she? Well, I'm almost finished the 4th book written by her, so I'm lapping them up. Number 9 is The Hallmarked Man, which is book 8 in the Cormoran Strike books by Robert Galbraith, aka J.K. Rowling. And number 10 is The Women, which has been a huge bestseller by Kristin Hannah.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You're listening to The Book Club on Talk Radio Europe. And keep listening. That's an instruction from Margaret Thatcher.
Joining us on the line now is Guy Lloyd. He's the International Sales Manager for Penguin Random House and joins us once a month to talk all things books. How are you, Guy?
Very well, Hannah. Good to be with you as always.
Yes, good to have you. Enjoying the summer in the UK. You've had some hot, hot moments.
We have. We've had the thermometer edging past 30 degrees, which is unheard of. Yeah. And of course, they issue warnings here when it gets past 30.
Yes.
Yeah, everyone's going to die. Don't go out of your house, which most Spanish people would laugh at.
Yes, it is a bit crazy, isn't it? One of the things which are amazing to see, Penguin 90th anniversary, which is incredible.
Yes, we are 90. Happy birthday to us this year. We are by no means the oldest publishing house. And when I say we, I mean Penguin is part of Penguin Random House now. But Penguin as a single entity, as a company, is 90 years old. It is not the oldest. In fact, I used to work for a company called W.H. Allen, who were founded in 1760. And I used to work for them at the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s. They've now actually been revived as an imprint within Penguin Random House, so the name is still going. I would probably think that the oldest publishing house still in existence in the UK is John Murray. They were founded in 1768.
Wow.
So Penguin is a relative youngster, but nevertheless, it's had a big impact. The founder of Penguin was a chap called Alan Lane, who was born in Bristol at the beginning of the 20th century. And he joined another publishing house called Bodley Head when he was 17. Bodley Head is still going. Alan Lane and Bodley Head are both imprints within the current Penguin Random House. But Bodley Head then was a separate publishing company, and it was founded by his uncle, a man called John Lane. But the story of how Penguin came to be was that Alan Lane was at Exeter Station, In 1934, he'd just visited Agatha Christie, like you do as a big publisher, and he wanted to read something for the journey home. And he realized that stations didn't sell books. They only sold newspapers and magazines if you wanted to read something. And that was because books were hardcovers. They were relatively expensive, and publishing them was very elitist. Some would say it still is, but that's probably for another program. And Alan Lane hit upon the idea of the paperback, which didn't exist really before then, and specifically cheap paperbacks of classic books that were out of copyright. And the key was that the books were small and portable enough to be sold from a vending machine. So you bought a book in the same way that you would buy a bar of chocolate or a can of Coke now. And the idea really caught on for two main reasons. One, books became cheaper. And Alan Lane had opened up a whole new market that actually some of the snobbier publishers didn't think existed. And secondly was the design, which were though everybody knows those sort of horizontal bands of cover, whether that's orange or blue or green, with the title in the same font right in the center. And after that, publishing was really never the same again. Alan Lane had a great quote about the business, which is he wanted to be missionary and mercenary. So he clearly wanted to make money. It was he was in business to make money. But at the same time, this was a mission statement to bring reading to a wider audience. And the success of the first Penguin paperbacks meant that Penguin started to develop other imprints, and all of them still exist now. So Pelican was formed in 1937, which does the nonfiction. Puffin in 1940, which is a children's imprint. And the interesting story of that was that 1940 was obviously during the war, and it was conceived as a collaboration with the UK government and Penguin as a wartime venture to bring cheap books to kids when raw materials were very scarce. So the government had been impressed by the sort of cheap and cheerfulness of Penguin's approach and thought that they could continue to supply children's books as a result. And there are millions of households that grew up on Penguin paperbacks. I mean, I still own editions that my parents bought decades ago, including a 1960 edition of Lady Chatterley's Lover by D.H. Lawrence. Incidentally, it cost 3 and 6, which for those not familiar with old money is 17.5p in new money. And it became Penguin's most famous paperback that very same year due to a very famous trial. So Lady Chatterley's Lover was originally published in 1928, and it was banned immediately for being obscene. And the UK government had introduced what many saw as quite a draconian Obscene Publications Act in 1959. And that affected not just book publishers, but writers, theatre companies. And Alan Lane wanted to test the new act, so he revived the publication of Lady Chatterley's Lover, and the government duly sued Penguin. And there was a trial that was front page news for weeks. And what most people remember about the trial was the government's prosecution lawyer asking the jury a question that went down in sort of legal infamy. Would you let your servant read this book? And if any quote exemplified kind of the UK class system and was also an indicator that times were about to change, it was this quote. And maybe partly as a result of that, Penguin won the case. Lady Chatterley's Lover was, of course, a massive bestseller. If you ban anything, whether it's books or records, then it immediately becomes a bestseller, including selling a copy to my father. But more importantly, it ushered in a change of mood, I think, at the start of the 1960s. And that brought changes not just in music and fashion, but laws legalizing homosexuality, divorce, the birth of the women's rights movement. And so it really did have a big impact. The other Penguin book that I can think of that was as newsworthy was The Satanic Verses by Salman Rushdie, which was published in 1988 and contained verses from the Quran that some Islamists found offensive, and Islamic extremists, particularly in Iran, the Ayatollah Khomeini, put a fatwa on Salman Rushdie and said it was the duty of all right-thinking Islamists to kill him. That fatwa still exists. And as we know, Salman Rushdie was attacked only a few years ago. And I remember working in publishing at that time, and colleagues who were going into Penguin had police officers with submachine guns either side of the entrance.
Oh, my goodness.
And airport-style security to get into the building. Salman Rushdie went into hiding for years. He didn't come out for several years. So that was something that caused a huge stink. And that brings us to Penguin Today. And of course, Penguin Today, as I've mentioned, is part of Penguin Random House. And that was a merger between the two big publishing houses of the day, Penguin and Random House, in 2013. And I was working for Random House in the sales office at the time. And I remember the stir that caused when the announcement came out. And as a result, Penguin Random House is now the biggest publisher in the world. It's part of the Bertelsmann Media Group in Germany, which has huge media interests all over the world. So it's come a long way since from an idea and a vending machine in Exeter Station. But here's to the next 90 years.
Oh, definitely. And thank you, Alan Lane.
Well, indeed. Yeah, he really was a pioneer.
Yeah. And talking of anniversaries and talking of pioneers, Jane Austen, 250th anniversary celebrations happening.
Yeah, there are. And there is big TV happening. So there's TV called The Elopement. And it's centered around an author called Jill Hornby, who wrote a fictional book a couple of years ago called Miss Austen, which imagined Jane Austen's sister Cassandra returning to the family home or the family village in search of a hoard of letters. And of course, letters in reality played a controversial part in Jane Austen's life because she famously burnt most of her correspondence, which scholars are still gnashing their teeth about because they wonder what insight was lost. And this fictional book became a TV dramatization called Miss Austen. So if you enjoyed it, you'll be pleased to hear of a second drama series that is based on Jill Hornby's second Jane Austen-inspired novel called The Elopement. The series won't be called The Elopement. It will be called Miss Austen Returns. But it will include most of the original cast, including Geely Hawes, who was in the first series. And we are promised the return of Cassandra, her sister, and a romance. So watch this space. But as you said, yeah, this is all part of a resurgent Jane Austen wave because it's the 250th anniversary of her birth this year. Mm. And weirdly, in the last couple of years, she's become as popular on TikTok with the YA generation as any modern romance author.
Isn't that amazing?
And there's a whole new generation that's been introduced to Jane Austen via TikTok and via the internet.
Gosh.
And there are tons, absolutely tons of reissues of all the regular novels this year. There is a box set of postcards coming from Penguin, which is 50 postcards. Each postcard features a cover of an old edition of a Jane Austen novel. And in case you think this barrel isn't being properly scraped, there is even a colouring book of Pride and Prejudice coming from BBC Books later in the year.
Brilliant.
So if you want something Jane Austen, you will be spoilt for choice this year.
Yes. I've interviewed Jill Hornby a couple of times, actually. She's lovely.
Have you?
Yeah. And there are some Jane Austen books coming up on the book show, actually. There's a few interviews in place with people who have brought out books to tie in with the 250th anniversary celebration. So, yes, watch this space too.
Really, it's a whole sub-industry of publishing at the moment.
There's a new bookshop that has opened dealing only in romance. What a great idea.
Well, indeed, yeah. It's called Saucy Books, which is a tremendous name. It opened in June, and it was billed as London's first romance-only bookshop. It's launched by a woman called Sarah Maxwell. And appropriately, it's based in Notting Hill, which is the scene of one of the UK cinema's most famous rom-coms. And you think, well, why romance-only? Isn't that, you know, it's difficult enough to run an independent bookshop. Doesn't this really limit your scope? But, I mean, we've talked about this in previous programs, but romantic fiction has been the fastest growing genre in the UK in the last 5 years. And it's changed dramatically. We used to think of romance even a decade ago as Mills and Boone or Barbara Cartland, and it was aimed at a very middle-aged or older female audience. and now nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, romance is the darling of the YA generation. You only have to look at TikTok again for that. It's made fortunes for modern authors like Josie Silver, Emily Henry, and it's branched out into a huge number of sub-genres. So we have fantasy romance, sports romance about people getting together across the tennis court or even on a ice hockey rink, historical romance, cowboy romance. There's a woman called Paisley Hope, who actually we bought from America, who's written a whole series of cowboy romance books. You name it, there is a romantic fiction strand written about it. So for the moment, Saucy Books isn't going to lack material, and best of luck to them. I hope they make a go of it.
Yeah, great idea. I'm going to see if I can get in touch with Sarah. I'd love to chat with her about her bookshop. And there's a new book coming out by Bradley Wiggins, his autobiography.
There is again. Yes, and we always hope this slot is a Christmas present solution for that difficult man. And it is probably going to be mostly men reading this in your life. So this is going to be called The Chain. It's coming out from HarperCollins, who published some very good sports books, on the 23rd of October. And I find this interesting in that of all the stars and the gold medal winners of London 2012, you know, we remember the huge success that that was and all the people, all the sports people who came out of that. Bradley Wiggins was probably the biggest. I mean, he won 5 gold medals. He was the BBC Sports Personality of the Year in what was probably the most competitive year ever. He later won the Tour de France. And yet of all these huge stars, he's probably kept the lowest profile since. So if you think of other people, Jessica Ennis-Hill, who won the heptathlon, she's a regular BBC TV pundit. She does the Olympics. She does the World Championships. She's very much a face on our TV screens now. Jason and Laura Kenny, the fellow cyclists, they've set up numerous initiatives. I've heard them on the media numerous times talking about things that they're doing with young people, as has Sir Chris Hoy. And Chris Hoy also, unfortunately, has a high profile following his cancer diagnosis, which is incredibly sad. But why not Bradley Wiggins? And it's because there has been a huge cloud after the 2012 Olympics of drug allegations, for which if his lawyers are listening, for the benefit of TRE management, he and Dave Brailsford, who was the head of the British cycling team, they were cleared. But it cast a shadow over the aftermath of his success. And Bradley Wiggins freely admitted that after 2012 he did suffer addiction. He was depressed, but having recovered from that, he's ready to tell his story. And it should be an interesting one. I mean, I think the Light and Shade memoirs, as awful as it is for the people who go through the dark moments, make for far more interesting reading because they're more relatable. All of us go through good times and bad times. And I always find the least interesting, particularly sports autobiographies, are people who are just relentlessly successful. Because in a way, it feels like they're so divorced from real life that they're not relatable. But I don't think that's going to be the case with this one. So watch out for The Chain in October.
Yeah, sounds good. And yeah, most people have had light and shade in their life, haven't they? I mean, you very rarely read an autobiography where everyone had a really happy childhood and things went really well for them the whole time.
Well, you're right. And in fact, there was a whole industry that came out of that autobiography genre. There's a sort of subgenre which became known as misery memoir. And it started from memory with a book that came out, I think, in the late 90s called If, by a man called Dave Peltzer.
Oh, yes.
And it was produced with quite a plain white cover. Mm. And those white covers became a staple of misery memoirs. They were hugely popular in supermarkets.
Yeah, Kathy Glass did lots of them.
Yeah. Exactly, all of those, and that they sold by the truckload. So for years, there was this subgenre called misery memoir that was as a result of Dave Peltzer's If. Mm. But you're right, it's very often the dark side that people go looking for.
Yeah, it says a lot about a human nature, doesn't it?
Yeah, doesn't it just? I think probably in these troubled times, we might be looking for something a little more uplifting, but yes. I still think it will be an interesting book.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being with us. As always, Guy Lloyd, International Sales Manager for Penguin Random House. And of course, if people want to see any books coming out by Penguin Random House or want to get in touch to find out about publishing with you, all the information is on the website.
It is, and I should point out that as a celebration for Penguin's 90th, we are reissuing 90 paperbacks that became Penguin classics. And the hook is that we're doing them in original covers with the year that they became a classic, Penguin classic, printed on the book. So it's going to be a great little series. Quite a big series, actually, 90 books. But watch out for that. And there's information about that on the website. Great. And lots more.
Oh, lovely. That's a nice idea. Wonder what you could possibly do in 10 years' time.
Well, indeed. The centenary is going to be a very big one indeed.
Yeah, amazing. Guy, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great summer.
Pleasure. Thanks, Hannah. You too. Bye.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Caroline James. She's the celebrated author of later life fiction, with her vibrant storytelling stemming from her colourful career. Before becoming a full-time writer, she carved out a fascinating path in the hospitality industry, owning a lively pub and then a charming country house hotel. As a media agent, she worked closely with celebrity chefs, giving her an insider's perspective on the glitz, glamour and grit of the culinary world. When she finally turned her focus to writing, she discovered her true calling, penning best-selling novels that have garnered her legions of fans. She's with us on the Book Show to talk about her new novel, The Cruise Club, where you can set sail on the Diamond Star for sunshine, romance, and just a little bit of mischief. Welcome to the Book Show, Caroline.
Oh, thank you so much, Hannah. What a lovely introduction. That was great.
Well, what a fabulous career it sounds like you've had. So many different things, all sounding fun.
Yeah, it's been quite a roller coaster, I can tell you.
So when you decided that you wanted to start writing, did you think, gosh, I've got a lot of material here with weird and wonderful people I've met along the way?
Yes, I probably did. Writing sort of came later in life to me, Hannah. I didn't start writing until my early 50s. I went to an all-girls grammar school, and I was told at school, you know, when you put your hand up and the career teacher says to you, what do you want to do? I bravely said, I want to be an author. And she told me that I wasn't clever enough and I should consider a job in retail. So that was a bit of a sucker punch, really, and my career then went in a completely different direction. But I never lost the dream of wanting to write, and going into the hospitality industry, it was certainly a good stage to, you know, hotels and restaurants are like revolving doors. There's always different people and characters coming through. So I sort of stored up lots of things in my head. And when I finally took the plunge, there was quite a lot to go at.
Oh, I bet. Gosh, isn't that awful that a teacher can say that? That sort of thing can impact a child throughout their life. And I mean, you'll prove you obviously still remembered it, but thankfully not taken too much notice.
Yeah, it's really true, that is. I think teachers do have a huge influence on you as well, don't they? And I remember a maths teacher telling me that I was... She said to me, you're stupid. I mean, I guess you could get away with that in grammar school all those years ago. But and I always did think I was daft at maths. I mean, I did eventually go back to college and do a hotel and catering diploma and other things. And I realised, actually, I wasn't that bad. I was quite good with maths, because running your own business in later years, you've got to understand how, you know, profit and loss accounts work and everything. So, yeah, you just have to keep going and not let anybody put you down, even at an early age, don't you? It's quite difficult when you're young. But as my dad always said to me, you've got to have a dream to make your dream come true. And I think that's stood me in good stead.
Yeah, lovely. And how did you know or work out the kind of books that you wanted to write?
I think the genre that I write in, which is later life fiction, I wouldn't say I fell into it, but I sort of developed it over crafting books. When I first started writing, when I wrote my first book, I thought, you know, it'd be easy to get a publisher. And it wasn't. I couldn't get a publisher or an agent, and I was rejected nearly, way over 80 times, and I decided to self-publish. So through that, over the years, I've been traditionally published and self-published. I'm now with HarperCollins. But it sort of came, it developed. And about 4 years ago, I got a complete contact out of the blue from an editor at HarperCollins. Her mother had read a book that I'd written called The Best Boomerville Hotel. I don't know if you remember the Marigold Hotel, Hannah. Do you remember the...
Yes.
Book and the films. Well, the book I'd written was sort of, reviewers said it was, kindly said it was Britain's answer to the Marigold Hotel. So it was about older characters in a hotel. And the editor's mother had read it and said to her, why aren't you publishing more books for people of my age? Her mum was 70. She said, you know, we like reading about older characters. So that's how my contract with HarperCollins came about, because we then, well, I came up with the idea for something called The Spa Break, which took four ladies in their 60s to a spa for the weekend to celebrate a 70th birthday. And I realised then, you know, as the book sort of really sold well, that there's a big market. And actually in the UK, the most prolific readers, I understand, are ladies over the age of 50. So it's finding your genre and tapping into the market. And for me, it was lovely because it was something I was really comfortable writing with.
Yeah.
Or writing about.
Absolutely. That's brilliant. And they say, write what you know, don't they? So, you know, it would be weird, I guess, writing about women in their 20s when you're no longer in your 20s. You know, you have to think back and remember. So it makes sense to write about people your age that you can relate to totally.
Yeah, I mean, my characters are sort of... I do have younger characters in the book, but they're generally 50s up, usually in the 60s. And, of course, they've got a lot of life experience. We've all got baggage. We've all got stuff that's happened to us. So there are lots of very rich stories to tap into with your creative head for characters of that age.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about the Cruise Club. Tell us about the main characters in this one.
The Cruise Club is set on a small ship. It was actually, I was inspired to write the book because I was a guest speaker on a Fred Olsen cruise that went around the Mediterranean. And I always remember when I joined the ship in Kefalonia, I walked through to the bar and there was an old elderly gentleman sitting at the bar wearing a captain's hat. I think he got it off eBay or somewhere. and a T-shirt with Lost at Sea written across the front. And as soon as I saw him, I thought, that's it, there's a book in here. There is definitely a book, because a cruise ship is a stage, isn't it? You know, and every day this old fella sat at the bar and he changed the T-shirt every day. So every day there was a different slogan. So that inspired the Cruise Club. And the Cruise Club is about Carmen, who is 53. She lives with her mum, and her mum, Betty, is 83, cantankerous and quite cruel to Carmen. They live together and they don't get on particularly well. And Betty is very demanding and Carmen sort of bends to her whims. Carmen is a cosy crime writer and she's got a mental block. She's got a deadline and she's nowhere near it. And purely by chance, she sees an advert in one of her mother's magazines for a cruise to the Mediterranean. And the guest speaker on the cruise is a gentleman called Ruskin Reeve, who is a very successful writer of detective stories. So thinking that this will get her going again, you know, break that writing block, she books to go on the cruise. Unbeknown to her, Betty books on the cruise as well. So that's how it starts off. Carmen and Betty Carmen's not very happy that her mum's there, but they join the cruise. And it's about the destinations that they visit as they journey through the Mediterranean. It's about the people that they meet on board, the friends they make, and how Carmen blossoms. But I'm told it's, the reviews have been fantastic. I'm told it's very humorous. It takes you on a real roller coaster ride. There's a lot of mischief. There's a lot of mystery with it. And like all good later life rom-coms, there's always a feel-good factor at the end.
Oh, nice. Love it. And did you take inspiration then from the places that you visited on the cruise that you were on?
Yeah, I did, Hannah, because I think it's, for me, I mean, everybody's different, aren't they? writing, you can do an awful lot of research on the internet, but I don't think there's anything really as good as physically being in the place, because I think things happen and characters develop, or you see things that you just can't get from an internet search. So the cruise club is very close to all the destinations that we visited on that particular cruise. You know, I made prolific notes, I watched people, I'd looked at where we were going and the things that were highlighted on the, you know, offshore and so on. And readers say to me, you know, I felt like I was on that cruise, or you've encouraged me to book a cruise because I've never been on one before, but I want to go on one now. So, yeah, I do think research, for me, I need to immerse myself in the place I'm writing about.
Oh, it's lovely to get that feedback, because it makes such a difference, doesn't it, that it's authentic, because you'll be sure that people will pick up your book because they like cruising. They might have done loads of cruises and been to the destinations that you talk about. So people will be very That's quick right. to go, oh, no, it's not like that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, it seems to have set off quite a few cruise titles that are coming up. I've written a book before that called The Cruise, which was set in the Caribbean. The current book I've nearly finished, the first draft, is called The Arctic Cruise, and next year we'll have The Nile Cruise. So I've got quite
lovely.
A lot of research.
Does that mean you'll have to research by going on those cruises?
Oh, it's terrible, isn't it? I know. Somebody's got to do it.
It's a hard life. And are you quite disciplined with your writing? Do you have set aside particular hours of the day that you like to write?
Yeah, I do. I have to be disciplined. Writing to me is a job. It's not a hobby. It's what pays the bills. So like any job, you know, you've got to focus and be really disciplined. So my best writing hours are in the early morning through till the afternoon. I will take a break, go and walk the dog or something like that. And I try and set a word count of 2,000 words a day when I'm sort of in full flow on the first draft. So that seems to work for me, and to maintain that, you know, to do that as many days in the week as I can, perhaps just having a Sunday off, because I find if I lose the thread, I lose the continuity, and maybe it's because my brain's not as sharp as it used to be, but if I lose the continuity, I'm going back over it all the time, and that tends to waste a bit of time as well. So yeah. I just like to get my head down and get on with it with that first draft.
And would you say you have a clear idea of all of the characters and the story arc before you start? Are you a plotter or a pantser?
I used to be a pantser, but I definitely plot now because I think it saves time. So at the beginning, I will have a synopsis. I'll have done an outline. It may take me, you know, a couple of weeks to do the outline or whatever. And then I will do a similar synopsis character outline for all the characters. That isn't to say that it changes. It doesn't change, because it does change. It can change quite a lot. I feel I don't really get to know the characters till I'm about halfway through, and then they start telling me the story, so it can go off in a very, very different direction. You know, it's like the branches of a tree. It sort of sprouts all over the place. You have to rein it in a bit sometimes, but on the whole, I start with the structure and then see where it goes, yeah.
Great. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Cruise Club, it's out now. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Caroline James, who we've been chatting with. Caroline, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. I hope that everybody enjoys the book. And yeah, have a lovely holiday with me. Thank you, Hannah.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Alex Fitzpatrick, who has contributed short stories to literary magazines and anthologies and has recently retired from teaching in order to devote herself to writing full time. Her summers spent with her Welsh family in Pembrokeshire inspired the creation of Meredith Island. The traditional mystery appeals to her keen interest in psychology, as she's intrigued by what makes seemingly ordinary people commit murder. She's with us on the Book Show to talk about the latest book in the Meredith Island series, A Dark Death. Welcome to the Book Show, Alice.
Thank you so much, Hannah.
It's great to have you with us. So tell me about your time in Wales and your connection there.
I was born in England. And we came to Canada when I was about 4.5 years old. And when I was 11 years old, my aunt and uncle bought a hotel in Tenby. And all the way through the 60s and on, so all the way through my teenage years especially, we would spend every summer in Tenby. And it was wonderful. It was there that I sort of fell in love with the Welsh people and the countryside. And I decided if I was going to write a series, I wanted it to be in a, you know, and you carry it around your head all the time as a writer. I wanted to be in a place that I really loved and I really enjoyed spending time there. So I decided to set the series in Wales.
Nice. And is it very different to where you live in Canada?
Well, it's on an island. I don't live on an island. and it's very reminiscent of sort of the original time I spent in Tenby, which is like my teenage years. And so it's sort of nostalgic and it's sort of full of wonder. And, it's just a really nice place to live until people start dying.
Well, yes, of course. Sorry, I meant it. Was there a connection between where you spent time in Wales? Does that have any similarities to where you live in Canada?
I always have to be near large bodies of water. And so I live in Toronto, which is on Lake Ontario, which is one of the largest bodies of water in North America. Mm. And so, yeah, I love that. I live in a big city. Toronto is one of the biggest cities in probably is the biggest city in Canada, whereas Meredith Island probably has only about 120 people in it. So I seem to be yearning for that small community feeling.
Yeah. So tell us about your main characters.
So my main characters are Kate Galway. Kate was born on the island. When she went to university, she left the island and basically stayed away, except for visiting her aunt, her grandparents every summer and Christmas. She's a retired teacher. She writes historical novels, although everyone thinks because she's a woman and she writes historical novels, they must be historical romance. No, they're not. They're historical literary, as she keeps reminding people. And she is very... Kate tends to be quite academic. She always wanted to be a university professor, but she got pregnant with her daughter, Alex, when she was finishing up her master's degree. So she ended up becoming an English teacher. But she thinks very academically. Her ex-husband is a police inspector, and her daughter is a barrister. So she's very conscious of, when she's solving her mysteries, of walking a very thin line between doing what a lot of amateur sleuths do and following the law. Her sidekick is Siobhan Fitzgerald. Siobhan is a sculptor and a potter, an artist, quite hedonistic, and very, and, you know, I came up with this quote about Siobhan, which I thought I'd come up with, but apparently other people are using it too. Not only did she think outside the box, she didn't know the box existed.
I like it.
And so they're very complementary, but they're all total opposites. But it's kind of good because Kate sort of will work with logic and research, where Siobhan will just come up with this crazy idea out of the blue, which sometimes turns out to be quite insightful. So they're a good combination.
And did we meet them all in the first book? Will readers already know the characters?
The readers already know the characters. There's a lot of islanders that they're introduced to, because in the first book, Kate is investigating the death of her aunt, who died when Kate was only 3 years old. Supposedly, she committed suicide just before she was about to leave the island to go to university. But the islanders always believe that she was murdered. So Kate comes back to bury her grandmother, who's the matriarch of the island. And she figures if she is going to come back to the island, she has to figure out what happened to her aunt. And it could be that there's a murderer still on the island. So a lot of she talks to a lot of the islanders who were alive when that summer that Emma died. So that's the first book. And in the second book, she's moved back to the island and she is solving a case that takes place at the time, a contemporary case.
And how did she become a kind of amateur sleuth? How did that happen?
It happened because she had to find out what happened to her aunt, and that was sort of the stimulus. Why would someone kill a young woman who was leaving the island in 2 weeks anyway? And so that was what she had to deal with. And the thing is that in traditional mysteries, there always has to be a reason why the amateur detective gets involved. It can't just be she's interested. Mm. So in the second book, a group of archaeology students come to dig for the remains of a medieval monk cell. And so one of the archaeology students is her university friend's son, who she's very close to. And he becomes one of the prime suspects in the murder. Also, the island mechanic becomes one of the prime suspects in the murder. So she gets involved in this murder because she wants to make sure that the real murderer is caught.
Okay, exciting. So is it quite difficult to plot when you've got lots of twists and turns and things? Do you have to do a lot of plotting beforehand or not necessarily?
I am not a plotter per se. I was having trouble finishing. I'm actually working on book number five, and I was having trouble finishing book number four. And I just kept putting it off. And finally I said, okay, I'm just going to plot the rest of the book. And the rest of the book was like the last three chapters. And then I had even more trouble finishing it. And what I recently read was there are people with the kinds of minds that if they can see, they can see what they have to do and they work it out in their minds in detail, their brain goes, oh, well, it's done. And they have trouble actually doing the work. And that's me. So, and I know there are other writers who will plot every single scene. They've got diagrams. They have things written out on recipe cards, which they move around. I can't do that. If I do that, I will never write the book. So what I do is I plot out up until the first murder. So that gives me something to go by. I often know how it's going to finish, but it's that middle bit that I struggle with. And I usually, when I'm writing, there are people who say, stop in the middle of a scene. I can't do that because I'm afraid when I come back to it, I'll forget what I was going to write. But I usually, when I stop, I sort of have an idea of what the next scene is going to be like. And I do sort of write bits and pieces going forward and then sort of try and fit them all together. But yeah, the middle for me, and I think a lot of writers, especially crime writers, will say this, the middle is the hard part. Because
yeah.
I know who the murderer is. I know how the murder happened in my mind because I have to know that in order to write up until that point. But then I have to figure out how they're going to solve the mystery, how they're going to solve it.
Yeah. And you have to find a way that works for you, don't you? There's no point seeing how other people do it and try to copy that. You have to find your own way.
Well, then the fact that there are actually two sets of people solving the mystery is Kate and Siobhan, and then there are the police. Because the police always come to the island and try to figure it out. And they sort of cross over because Kate's former student, Byron Finch, actually was inspired by her stories of her husband or ex-husband now. And he became a police officer. So he's now training to be a detective. And so she's always pumping him for information. A lot of this is how does she learn what she learns and what the police know that they're not telling her. And it's sort of that balance of how does she get information out of people and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And do you know how many there's going to be in the series?
I'm going to keep going.
Forever.
Forever. Louise Penny, who's the top crime writer here in Canada, I think is just publishing her 20th book. So I'm going to keep going.
Wow.
One of my favorite writers is Ellie Griffiths. And she just finished the Ruth Galloway series. And I think there's like 15, 16 books in that. So
yeah. Well, if people want to get a copy of A Dark Death, it's available now on our website, tre.radio. And it's by Alice Fitzpatrick, who we've been chatting with today. Alice, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
This is Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Welcome to the second part of tonight's book show. In the first hour, we were chatting with Guy Lloyd, Caroline James, and Alice Fitzpatrick. In this hour, we're chatting to Imogen Edwards-Jones, an award-winning journalist, broadcaster, novelist, and screenwriter. She wrote the hugely successful Babylon series, which has sold 1.5 million copies in the UK. For her latest book, she's teamed up with none other than James Patterson, one of the best-known and biggest-selling writers of all time, to write The Last Days of Marilyn Monroe. It tells the extraordinary story of her life and the shocking circumstances of her death. We're also chatting to Menna van Praagh, who was born in Cambridge and studied modern history at Oxford University. She lives in Cambridge and sets her novels among the colleges, cafes, and bookshops of the city. Her Magical Cambridge collection, consisting of five novels, most recently The Patron Saint of Lost Souls, are love letters to the cobbled streets and quirky shops of Cambridge, an enchanting blend of everyday whimsy, the love stories of very human characters, and a joyful dash of magic. And finally, we're chatting to Virginia Evans, who attended James Madison University for her bachelor's in English literature. After starting a family, she went back to school for her master's of philosophy and creative writing at Trinity College Dublin. The Correspondent is an emotional, uplifting story about great joys, small tragedies, and unexpected second chances. In her letters to family and friends, we come to know the life of Sybil van Antwerp, stubborn, cantankerous, opinionated, always steadfast in her belief in the power of the written word. And that is tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
The pen's in my hand, ending unplanned. Staring at the blank page before you, open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate.
Joining us on the line now is Imogen Edwards-Jones. She's an award-winning journalist, broadcaster, novelist, and screenwriter. She wrote the hugely successful Babylon series, which has sold over 1.5 million copies in the UK alone. She has co-authored a new book, which is already in the bestseller charts, with none other than James Patterson, one of the best-known and biggest-selling writers of all time. It's called The Last Days of Marilyn Monroe, and it tells the extraordinary story of Marilyn's life and the shocking circumstances of her death. For decades, fans have speculated about the truth of her final days. Was it suicide, a tragic accident, murder? Well, this book seeks answers drawn from rigorous research. Welcome to the book show, Imogen.
Oh, thanks, Hannah. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. And you?
Very good, very good. It's school holidays,
so, you know.
The joy of that.
Lovely. I believe you.
Yes.
We were trying to work out how long ago it was since we last spoke. It was years. I mean, it must have been at least 5 years. I'm guessing you've done quite a lot in that time.
I've done quite a lot of typing in that time, yes. I know. I mean, I've written 3 books in a year and a half, so I'm, I know, which has been quite punchy.
Wow.
And Two of them were ghosts, have been ghosting for other people. And then this one, the last one, the other one was the James Patterson one, which is co-authored with James, which is the Marilyn book. But yes, I've been, you know, hard at it. I'm going to hopefully lie down for a bit of the summer and not actually do anything.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah. But it's been, you know, if you get the opportunity to work, then I suppose you have to work, don't you?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And talking of opportunities, how did this come about with James Patterson?
Do you know what's really interesting? I was talking to somebody who was trying to ask about who they would recommend, if I could recommend somebody to work with James Patterson, and they wanted somebody who was a journalist and somebody who was a novelist and somebody who'd, and then halfway through the sentence, they just stopped and went, "Oh no, it's you. Would you like to do it?" So that's how it came about. And I had to do various tasters for him. So I had to do, and also you have to learn to write in the style of James Patterson, which is quite an interesting concept because he's a sort of thriller writer and he's a best-selling writer. And that's a technique of writing that I hadn't really done before. So very short sentences, very big verbs, and all in the present tense. So it was a really interesting concept of working with him as to how you could gel with his style.
Yeah, amazing. So where did you go from there? I mean, how do you go about writing a book with someone else for a start? It sounds like it could be complicated.
It is quite complicated. I mean, he's a brilliant writer and a brilliantly professional. So I couldn't have been paired up with somebody better. What was extraordinary was, so I did a whole load of trying to work out how to pace the book and blah, blah, blah. And then there's this one moment when I'm having a discussion and I said, well, obviously, then we start with when Marilyn was born, you know, in Dickensian poverty in Los Angeles. And talk about how she was an orphan and she ended up in an orphanage. And then he just said, no, Imogen, that's just all backstory. So, oh my God, okay, so we've got to start somewhere else. So it was really interesting process collaborating with somebody who's so professional and has done this type of book so many times before. So it was a massive learning curve for me.
Yeah. And he's used to collaborating, isn't he? He's done lots of books with
hundreds of people he's collaborated with, and not least Bill Clinton.
Yes.
I don't profess to be in his league, but yes. So he's famous. I mean, he writes so many books a year that it's impossible not to collaborate, I think.
Yeah.
And if you look at his sort of backlist, I mean, I think he's probably written about, you know, over 200 books or something. And he's absolutely prolific. But he knows exactly what he's doing, and there's no fat on the beast at all. It's literally, when you read it, it's like a knife through butter. There's no flim flam. There's no, you know, I mean, that's why they're bestsellers, because it takes you straight through. I mean, they're unputdownable is a phrase often used, but I would say that was most definitely his style.
Yeah. And after the initial kind of working out who does what, was it pretty clear and kind of easy once you got into it? Did you have clear roles as to what you were doing and what he was doing?
Yeah. So I did most of the research, which is what I really wanted to do. I mean, Marilyn herself is a fascinating character. I sort of totally fell in love with her and got very obsessed with her. And you can understand why she's got so many fans still now, you know, despite the fact that she died in 1962. She's absolutely extraordinary, sort of beguiling personality that comes off the page in such a way. And that's the thing I really enjoyed most, was doing a deep dive into her life. And also what's interesting is most of the books that are written about Marilyn, I think bar one or two, have been written by men. So it was very interesting to have a female angle on her life, because, and also it's a sort of post Me Too book as well, in that, I mean, the level of abuse that she received at the hands of the casting couch and the gentlemen, well, not gentlemen producers, or the agents, or the, I mean, she was pushed around from pillar to post. And I think from a female point of view, I think that's quite an interesting angle to go in on, because it's mostly from the male gaze that you get to look at Marilyn.
Yeah. And also because she was so beautiful, and so much of her is about how she looks and how she came across on screen, when you're writing a book about her, you've got to sort of bring those visuals to the page, which I guess is quite a challenge.
Yes. I mean, we're fortunate now that a lot of the books that that I've read and took notes from, et cetera, had not... they didn't have the luxury of the internet. So I can sit here in my office and look at photographs of, like, you know, the Some Like It Hot dress or whatever glittery ball gown she wore to whatever event. And I can get the colours absolutely right. I can get the cut right. I can get the designer correct, because I can do proper research. And some of these books that have been written before have got, you know, quite a few things that are actually incorrect. Because it was so difficult to cross-check facts, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And there's so much myth about Marilyn and so much mythology. And the worst, sort of most unreliable narrator of her life was actually her. Mm-hmm. So she would reinvent herself all the time and tell, you know, lie about her age, where she came from. You know, she kept her mother a secret for years, saying that her mother was dead. In fact, she was in a mental institution. So Marilyn is, you know, the worst narrator of her own life anyway. So it was quite a difficult deep dive to do, because there are so many things that people say that aren't true. But anyway, I hope it's as accurate as it can be.
Yeah.
But it is quite hard to get every duck in a row with her, because... you know, even her diaries aren't entirely factual.
And it must have been difficult, because there has been so many books and films and documentaries and TV series made about her and her life and her death to a certain extent. It must have been quite difficult, quite challenging to find out lots of information that you didn't already know, or that the public, yes, the general public didn't already know. That's obviously really important to be giving something new to people.
Yes, it's also what I realised halfway through is that there are certain figures or historical figures, and she is an historical figure now, I suppose, that people are obsessed with. So you get Marilyn fanatics, and I, much like you, weirdly, you get Marie Antoinette fanatics. Mm-hmm. And I, one of the other books, which I think I spoke to you about before, about that I wrote about Rasputin, and you get Rasputin fanatics. So it is slightly like kicking a hornet's nest when you start writing something like this, because inevitably people will accuse you of saying something that's not true, or that they don't believe to be true, and therefore they suddenly accuse you of being inaccurate. And it's just their idea of what is accurate is not the same as what your idea of what is accurate is. Mm. And so that you get, I mean, it is quite a hot potato to be writing about, I suppose, if that's the...
Yeah. And with regards to your own opinions on her death, did you have an idea of what you think happened that maybe changed as you were writing the book?
Yes, you see, in the book that I've written with James, there's lots of different theories about what happened to her right at the very end. And the truth of the matter is that nobody actually really knows. And the other truth of the matter is that if it were a cover-up by either the Kennedys or the CIA or the FBI or the Mafia, which are all the people who are in the frame for it, at least, 100 to 150 people would have to be complicit in the cover-up, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, even from the autopsy was a disaster. There's a point within the autopsy that Marilyn's organs are tested for barbiturates, but then they're thrown away and they're never kept, so they can't be retested. There's a moment in the autopsy where she's put into a cupboard for some reason for about 3 hours, because nobody knows where to put the body. Because there are so many people trying to photograph it, and I mean, it's just the chaos surrounding her death is extraordinary. You know, there are rumours of Bobby Kennedy flying in a helicopter. He was at some conference in San Francisco and supposedly flew in a helicopter to see her on the day that she died. She's got enough barbiturates in her bloodstream to kill about five people, and yet there are no pill shells in her stomach. So the stomach is empty. Which is very odd. There's a tiny injection point on her hip, supposedly, which is the idea of somebody gave her what's known as a hot shot to murder her. I mean, the theories are endless. She's got doctors on tap all the time who are coming in and out. You know, she's rumoured to have died at about 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock in the morning, and yet nobody discovers her until about 3:30 in the morning. And then there's a delay in calling the police. And, you know, it's just a miasma of madness, as far as I can work out. But the one thing that I thought was there was one image that keeps recurring in every single account of it is... that her housekeeper, a woman called Eunice Murray, is constantly washing bed sheets. So I think something happened before, and Marilyn was obsessed with sleep, obsessed with barbiturates, and also, bizarrely, she used to use enemas and colonic irrigation all the time. So there is a theory that she was given a barbiturate enema and overdosed with that at about midnight, 11 o'clock. And so hence the washing of the sheets, hence the amount of barbiturates in her system, but nothing in her stomach. So to me, that would be where I would put my £10. Mm. But there are so many other fascinating theories. There was a man called Fred Otash, who is... supposedly working for the CIA or the FBI or the mafia, who is listening in. He's got her whole house is wired, and the famous wiretaps have never been heard or found. I mean, it's an extraordinary story, and it's fascinating to delve into as to which avenue you can go down.
Yeah. And presumably the housekeeper was interviewed at the time. I mean, did she not have any interesting insights?
No, well, she was the one who... so the famous story is that the housekeeper discovered her dead with the light on and the telephone underneath, the telephone cord going underneath the door, and the door was locked. And Marilyn famously never locked her door because... as an orphan, she'd been in orphanages all her life, and she was terrified of being locked in anywhere. Absolutely terrified. So she never locked anything. Anyway, Eunice Murray then calls Dr. Greenson, who is the doctor, who then breaks into Marilyn's bedroom, and she's found dead, on the naked, with the telephone in her hand. That is the story that everyone knows. And she was interviewed, but she never really said anything. Mm. And then all those characters suddenly disappear. Mm. And they're never interviewed again. Well, because as soon as the coroner declared it suicide, there is no case. So yeah. Therefore, there is no case. There's no reason for the police to interview anybody. If it's death by suicide, which was strangely said very quickly, that she died by suicide. And... so therefore, there's no police case, nothing active. Nobody needs to be interviewed, and they can all go home.
Yeah. And so do you think if somebody like Marilyn was found under the same conditions and in the same circumstances today, do you think things would be handled any differently? Do you think there would be different conclusions that people would have come to?
Most certainly. And also, I mean, she did have a terrible history of drug abuse. She did have a terrible history of overdosing on barbiturates. She'd overdosed two, if not three times before her death. So she wasn't a sort of a clean skin, as it were. She had form for all of that. But But even so, I think it would have been treated in a very different way. And I think people ask much more in-depth questions these days. I don't think people would have got away with such sort of obvious obfuscation when they didn't tell the truth, or a lot of the stories that were alibis, none of them really correlated. Her phone records went missing almost immediately as soon as she died. So the exchange where they kept all the phone records in Hollywood, all her phone records were taken, stolen, or requested, who knows. Mm. They disappeared. So there's lots of things that don't match up, which is why it's a field day for conspiracy theorists, as you can imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, there are lots of things like that point to a cover-up, aren't there?
Yes.
You know, things going missing, people disappearing. I mean, it all sets off those alarm bells, doesn't it?
Totally. And also, you know, she did have an affair with Bobby Kennedy, and she did have an affair with Jack Kennedy, and she was furious that they had both decided to sort of, as my daughter would say, chuck her. And, so she'd been chucked. She'd been chucked by both of them, and she was absolutely livid, and she was apparently going to call a press conference on the Monday morning. And she died on the Sunday morning. On the Monday morning, to basically tell the world how she'd been passed around by the brothers and how they'd both used her and abused her, in quotes, like a piece of meat. That's what she had said. So she was furious about them. And there was a sort of pincer movement between her publicist and the Kennedys to try and stop her from speaking to the press. So much so that the publicist took her out to dinner for the Friday night before she died in order to fill her full of enough alcohol to sleep for hours and hours and hours, so that she didn't wake up and speak to the press on the Saturday. And her publicist spent the night with her on the Friday night in order to make sure that Marilyn didn't speak to the press. So I think they knew that there was something coming down the line, and very fast, and it was her, and she was absolutely furious.
Yeah.
So there was good reason for them to silence her.
Mm, it's all very convenient, isn't it?
It's very convenient, I know. I know. But the one fact that I did find out, which I thought was so deeply disturbing, was she's buried in Los Angeles, and she's in this sort of pretty grave. It's a sort of hole in the wall, basically, with her name on it. And it's always covered in lipstick kisses. And Joe DiMaggio famously delivered a dozen red roses to her grave every year for, I think it was 15 years after she died. And the creepiest thing was that Hugh Hefner, of Playboy fame, obviously, Hugh Hefner paid extra money to lie next to Marilyn for eternity. So he bought the next door grave in the cemetery so that he could be the person lying next to Marilyn forever.
That's weird, isn't it?
Isn't that just horrible? I just keep thinking, even in death, she's being sex-pested by people.
Yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, not shocking that it's him, because he was weird as well, wasn't he, really?
but that made me so deeply depressed about the whole thing. It was like, oh my God, really? Mm. Poor, poor woman. I mean, I really, really was Team Marilyn by the end of it all. She was incredibly clever, incredibly bright. Nobody ever gave her credit for that.
Mm.
She was one of those autodidacts that read everything, was desperate to learn everything. She really took her acting seriously. She was extremely clever.
Yeah.
And she's always known as sort of like the dumb blonde, but that's absolutely not the case.
Mm. Well, it's can't wait to read the book in full. It's really exciting. It's called The Last Days of Marilyn Monroe. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by James Patterson and Imogen Edwards-Jones, who we've been chatting with today. Imogen, thank you so much for joining us. Lovely to chat with you again.
Thanks, Hannah. Thank you so much for asking me.
Hello. Little Alan Bennett here. If I'm not writing books, then the thing I like most is listening to the book club on Talk Radio Europe. fancy.
Joining us on the line now is Menna van Prague, who was born in Cambridge and studied modern history at Oxford University. She lives in Cambridge and sets her novels among the colleges, cafes and bookshops of the city. She's with us on the book show to talk about the fact that Alison and Busby are reissuing five of her magical realism novels. The books were a forerunner of the burgeoning healing fiction genre with their cozy, transformative storylines. It's a collection of books that mix romance, characters on life-changing journeys, and a sprinkling of the supernatural. Welcome to the book show, Menna.
Thank you very much, Hannah.
It's lovely to have you with us. So you wrote these books like 10 years ago, didn't you? How lovely that they're all being reissued. How did that all come about?
Yes, that was lovely. And they now have beautiful new covers, which is always fun because I'm a big collector of novels and I love to collect editions with different covers. I was very honoured by that.
Yeah, really nice. And are these a series of five books? When you wrote the first one, did you intend for them to be a series of five? Because they have different characters, don't they?
Yes, so I would say they are they're not strictly a series, as in they don't follow each other. So you can read them in any order you like, or just read one or two, whatever. But one thing I did do was set them all in Cambridge, and then I had characters from each novel then visit the next novel.
Mm.
So, you know, to create a kind of world, which yeah. I really enjoy.
Nice. So for people who haven't visited Cambridge, how would you describe it as a city and why you think it's such a great place to set novels?
Cambridge is enchanting. It just is. Everywhere, well, not everywhere, but so much of where you go. I think it's partly the history. You go down streets and you feel as though you've stepped into the 1800s. All of the beautiful colleges are right at the centre. So I would argue that it is slightly more enchanting and beautiful than Oxford, even though I spent five happy years there. But it's just, it seems rich with magic. It seems that anything could happen in any place. And you can go punting through the colleges on the river, and you can wander down the streets at dusk. And it's just a very, very special place to be.
Oh, lovely. And how do you explain the genre that they're written in, magical realism? What does that mean?
So I would say that magical realism is that there's a heavy emphasis on the real. So they're all set in the real world and everything is very grounded. And then magical realism is different from fantasy in that you're taking things that almost could be real. So they're sort of real adjacent there. Ghosts, you know, the kind of thing that we've all had the experience, well, not all, but many of us have had the experience of being maybe feeling a shift in the room or being visited by, you know, feeling the presence of someone who's died. And many people have said they've seen ghosts. You know, it's not a great leap. Ghosts arrive in a lot of literary fiction as well. An example would be that they say, you know, cook. If you cook and you love the food and you love the people, people can taste your love in the food. That's very much a real idea. And for example, in The Witches of Cambridge, I took that to, you know, a slightly heightened level whereby one of the characters cooks food and she can influence the emotions of the people who eat her food.
Yes, it talks about the, obviously it's called The Witches of Cambridge, but you say they've been meeting for over 900 years to discuss books and drink hot chocolates on the roofs of the colleges. What a lovely image.
Well, that was lovely. That came out of a conversation I had with a friend who said, you know, how often do we look up? Cambridge is so beautiful and you're always looking at everything. But do we look up at the turrets and the towers of the colleges? And then we were both wanting to start a book group. And we thought, well, what if you had a book group, but if you're witches, you might have it in a really fun, exciting place. You might have it at the top of the turrets of the colleges and you could look down on all the people below.
Nice one. Then there's also one in the series, The House at the End of Hope Street, which is about Alba, and she goes to stay at a place in Cambridge whose past residents include Virginia Woolf and Agatha Christie.
Well, that came out of a desire that I had. I thought, well, if I was really rich, I would create a house where artists could stay for a year and just create art, because most of us, I mean, it took me 10 years to get published because I had to work at the same time. You know, most people can't dedicate a year of their life to writing or art or whatever it is they want to do. So that came out of the idea of having a house that would take care of you in a very real fashion. And then I just made the house a little bit magical. So the house has a character, the house has a presence, and the house adapts itself according to the residents.
Mm. Oh, I like that. What a lovely idea. I'd live there.
Yes, exactly. I think most people would live there. And then I thought, well, it could be inhabited by the spirits of all of the, you know, great authors that I love. And then it was very fun to research the writings of Virginia Woolf, of George Eliot, and Agatha Christie, Daphne du Maurier, and imagine what it would be like if they were having conversations together.
Yeah, oh, amazing. Love that. Then we have The Lost Art of Letter Writing, about a character called Clara. And there's this little shop where people go to write letters to people.
That came out of a desire to open a stationery shop because I love stationery. I collect it. I spend far too much money on it. I write about 3 letters a week and it makes me sad.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, I love letter writing, and I have a couple of friends who love it too, so we write each other letters. Even though we meet for coffee, we still write each other letters.
Oh, that's lovely.
So we're not far away from each other, but we love getting letters in the post, and it just made me sad that most people just send texts and emails nowadays, and how are we going to read literary letters from now on? They're just going to be... that, you know, they're just not going to be there anymore. I have a beautiful book, The Collected Letters Between Virginia Woolf and Vita Sackville-West. You know, that's not happening anymore. So I thought, well, I can't open a stationery shop because it would be commercial disaster. I mean, no one would buy it. And anyway, I can't run a shop because it's far too practical. So when I have these fantasies, I tend to write about them instead. And I thought, what if we have a woman who writes letters to strangers, telling them things that they need to know in their lives. And that was the beginning of that book.
Mm, great. And then we have The Dress Shop of Dreams. Was that also a dream? Would you like to have a dress shop?
Good question. No, actually. But that's set on All Saints Passage, one of my favourite magical streets in Cambridge. It's just enchanting. And there was a tailor's there. And that came from the idea of, again, a very real experience that I think we've all had, of when you put on different clothes, you feel like a different person.
Mm.
And if you have a really fantastic piece of clothing, you feel more confident, you feel more beautiful, you feel that you could really do anything, you know, sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so I took that to another stage whereby the dressmaker would sew a little magical symbol into the dresses that she makes that would kickstart people on the, you know, course to their heart's desire, basically.
Oh, lovely. And finally, the patron saint of lost souls. This is about Jude, who owns an antique shop in Cambridge and makes it her mission to match customers with the special something that they are missing.
Yes, that came from just loving to collect antiques. I am a collector of things. If you saw my office, It's just full of stuff, stationery, books, and collectible things. So it was an enchanting location for me. That was set on Green Street, which is another beautiful street in Cambridge that many tourists miss. And there was a lovely shop there called Catesby's, and I visited it often. And they had a lovely cafe, and they weren't antiques, but I just changed it into being antiques because then we have the history, we have the past lives of the people who owned the things. And to me, that gives them an extra special feeling. And it's not too far of a leap to think that they could be imbued with some kind of life-changing properties.
Yeah. Oh, fabulous. So what new things are you working on at the moment?
Well, after writing the magical realism novels, which I really enjoyed, I decided to break into fantasy, which is taking it more in the direction of the truly fantastical with dragons and other worlds and all that stuff. I didn't have any dragons, actually, but other worlds. And then I am now working on some historical fiction.
Oh, wow.
With a fantastical edge, because I studied history. I've always wanted to write historical fiction, but it can be hard for writers to segue into other genres. So I'm writing historical fiction, but with a magical edge.
Mm. So do you enjoy the challenge of trying something in a different genre? Because there are some authors that are very successful, but stay in the same genre their whole career. And I do find it impressive when when authors go to different genres, because it must be quite a different experience.
It is a challenge. I think I've embraced it because I teach creative writing, and I'm always telling my students to be adventurous. And at some point, you've got to take your own medicine, take your own advice, don't you? You can't just be telling other people to have courage. So my analogy would be with actors who get typecast and they always play the same parts. And I think as writers, it does take courage, but it is an exciting experience. I remember when my editor, Alison and Busby, she said, you know, how many of these can you write in the magical realism series? And I thought, oh, loads. But actually, after five, I didn't have any more in me.
Yeah.
I wanted to explore something new, something different. I would never be able to write a whole series of, I don't know, 20 books or something. I want to explore different things. So last summer, I was at a bit of a loose end, and I decided to write some crime fiction because I'd never written crime, and I thought I couldn't do it. And I'm very much into the, is that true? Questioning your thoughts. Can you not do something you think you can't do? So then I wrote a series of cozy crime novellas called The Biscuit Tin Murders, and I just self-published them for fun over the summer. And that was great. So, you know, I like to do a little bit of everything.
Yeah, that's really great. And it must keep writing interesting and exciting. I mean, no writer wants to be in the position where you're like, okay, got to churn out another of these crime books now, you know, as if just going through the motions. You want to be enjoying what you're doing. And for the most part, that's why people get into writing in the first place, because they're really passionate about it and enjoy it. So
Absolutely true. And I don't read the same novels. You know, I like to explore all different sorts of novels. So I like to write different sorts of novels. And like you say, it would be rather tragic, wouldn't it, if we were saying, oh, gosh, it's such a gift to be a writer. And if you sat down and go, oh, I've got to knock out another Poirot novel or something. You know, you want to keep yourself on your toes. Yeah,
definitely. Well, if people want to have a look at the magical Cambridge collection that we've been talking about, the books are The House at the End of Hope Street, The Witches of Cambridge, The Lost Art of Letter Writing, The Dress Shop of Dreams, and The Patron Saint of Lost Souls. And they're all available on our website, tre.radio, by Menna van Praag, who we've been chatting with today. Menna, thank you so much for joining us. Lovely to chat with you again.
Thank you so much, Hannah. It was my pleasure.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Virginia Evans. She attended James Madison University for her bachelor's in English literature. After starting a family, she went back to school for her master's of philosophy and creative writing at Trinity College, Dublin. She's with us on the book show to talk about her new novel, The Correspondent, an emotional, uplifting story about great joys, small tragedies, and unexpected second chances. In her letters to family and friends, we come to know the life of Sybil van Antwerp, stubborn, cantankerous, opinionated, always steadfast in her belief in the power of the written word. Welcome to the book show, Virginia.
Thank you, Hannah. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. And what a lovely idea for a novel. Where did it come from?
Thanks. The book really came for me. It started with, I wanted to write a novel in letters, and I had read 84 Charing Cross Road, which I know is a beloved classic, but yeah, I had never read it before until I think I read it in late 2020. And I had the experience that I think as readers we're all always trying to have, which is finding a book that you just can't put down and you put your whole life on hold and you read it until it's done, sort of. And that was the experience I had reading that book. And I got to the end and I've written other novels, and so I've had this experience before, but I reached the end of that book and I thought, I want to do that. I want to try to do that, or some version of that. And so I started to kind of dream up the idea of a book in letters telling a full life. And then it was sort of the matter of what type of a person would be able to write enough letters or would be able to tell their kind of their life story through letters. And so that's where it really started. But then I did feel it could get a little dull, you know, if you're just sort of in one person's head. So then it really became a full cast of so many, you know, such a variety of people that the character, my character Sybil, writes to, and then those people who write back to her. But it really did start with that old good classic 84 Charing Cross Road.
Oh, nice. So yeah, I was thinking actually when you were saying, I was wondering whether it's just letters that Sybil have written and thought it would be nice get her getting letters back from other people. So that's great. That's what you did. And I suppose that gives more of an insight into her, what other people are saying to her.
Yeah, I think it does. And it also just brings, you know, interest to the story. Really what, you know, you are getting a really full portrait of her life, kind of things that have happened. Now she's in her 70s when the book begins, and you're getting the story of her life, but also so many other, you know, a good handful of other people's lives, the people that she kind of overlaps with. And I was so interested in this idea of, you know, a full picture, but also how our lives are not in a vacuum, and every person that we interact with also has their own story happening in their own life. And so I think a lot of the joy for me in the book was the other characters and the other storylines that were kind of happening in tandem with Sybil's life, but also fully on their own. I almost felt like you could spin off a story about each of the other characters that are her corresponding partners. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's really fun.
So who else do we meet? Can you tell us about some of the other characters?
Yes. Yeah. Sybil has been writing kind of throughout her life to her sister-in-law. They were best friends as children, and then they married brothers. And so she still has this friendship, but Sybil has divorced her brother that she married, like the brother that she married, but her best friend that married the other brother is still married to him. So they're not technically related anymore, but they write to each other. She strikes up a kind of friendship with a customer service representative from an online retail company, which is pretty funny. She writes back and forth with her brother who lives in France. She has a few suitors in the book. One is her neighbor and one is far away and lives in Texas. And she writes letters with them. She writes letters to a younger boy. He's the son of a former colleague, and he's troubled and sort of has a really challenging time in his life socially. So she has sort of befriended him and is a mother figure to him, where his mother, his real mother, is absent. Just a pretty big variety. Some of it's comical and some of it's more serious. I guess people are always asking me how I decided that she should be corresponding partners with Joan Didion, because she is in the book frequently writing back and forth with Joan Didion. And so that's, a fun kind of literary person's point of interest. But it was just sort of an idea of a person who thinks they can write to anybody or say anything, what variety of people they might end up writing with. And with the variety of people, she sort of writes herself in different ways. Like, she will disclose certain things to certain people, and then she'll disclose totally different things to other people. And she's very self-protective in that way. So if there's things that she doesn't want to show to someone, she won't show those things, but she might show those things to someone else. And so the value of that in terms of the narrative is that you can get this multidimensional view of her because she has so many different varieties of corresponding partners.
Interesting. And even though she's stubborn and opinionated and cantankerous, do you think people will like her? Is that the idea?
I think people will. I mean, that's been the response. I've certainly had a variety of responses to her. I mean, some people don't like her, which, that's fine. She is all of those things. She's very opinionated, and some of her opinions are sharp, and she is stubborn. And I think those things are true. It's almost, to me, when I was writing the story, it's almost like, in not necessarily a grumpy old woman, but a woman of a certain kind of upbringing and generation that just is unapologetic, and to a fault, says things that are direct and blunt and can be rude or unfeeling. But, I think her heart is always good. I think, her heart is good from the beginning. She just has a tough way of communicating. And I know people like that the communication is, can be very brusque, but the sentiment and the heart behind it is true and good. And from the beginning of the book, pretty much from the beginning, that she's in her 70s, but when she was a young mother, one of her children died. And so it kind of starts off as a very small sliver of who she seems to be, is that she has this long grief, and that informs a lot of her kind of callous outer person. But as the story goes on, it becomes, you come to see that that is not a slim sliver of her life. It's a big part of her life. And it's something she just hasn't really dealt with, the loss of her son. And so I hope, and I think as you read the book, you might have moments of Sybil frustration or disappointment in her, or thinking, you have to do better towards her. But then I think as the book goes on and you see these kinder, softer sides of her, and then also learn about the circumstances of her long grief, you start to feel for her and empathize with her. And she's complicated, but I think everybody's complicated.
Yeah, definitely. And I also think, one of the perceived joys of getting older is caring less about what people think and speaking your mind. And, I think a lot of people worry about things like that throughout their life. And as they get older, not everybody, but some people are very much, oh, I don't really care anymore. I'm just going to say what I think. And I kind of love that.
I do too. And, there is something, I've been interviewed about the book, a few times, and people have said, are there parts of me in her? Did I write myself into her at all? And, my sort of first thought or response to that is no. I don't think so. She's older and wiser and different than me, but I actually think there are almost parts of me that are more hidden. And I do wonder if exactly what you're saying, like, as I get older, I hope I can be more unapologetically myself and not be so concerned with politeness all the time at the, you know, to the detriment of being truthful or, and I think there's certainly a fine balance, and there are things that she says and does in her life and in the book that I still think, oh, Sybil, why could you not have done better? But I think that's true I look at my own life and I think, oh, Virginia, why couldn't you have done better? Could you not have said that with more kindness or behaved in a better way? So I just, you know, it's funny. It's writing fiction now. It feels like a dance in some ways. There's a nervousness sometimes with saying the right thing or the wrong thing. And it feels hot. You know, sometimes you just have to sometimes tread carefully, I think. But I wanted to bravely write a person that I felt was a real person, you know, with all of the faults and with the faults and the qualities that are admirable. And so I think by doing that, you know, you do run the risk of offending, you know, there are certain things she says that are offensive to me, but I think they're true to her. And so I was trying to be honest about who she was.
Yeah. I think that's great. I think it would be remiss if she was a perfect person, because they don't exist, do they?
That's right. That's right. And I think, you know, it's this idea of like who we are and who we display when we leave our house, you know, like who we are at the shops or who we are at a dinner party, who we are at our children's school is like the best version of ourselves, or we try for it to be the best version of ourselves. But I wrote this essay a couple of years ago. I had this old dog that died, and I wrote this essay about how the dog is the only one who sees the whole real thing, because it's the dog only sees you at home. And I think that's true. All of us, you know, at home, you know, as a proverbial kind of statement, who we are at home is who we are, you know, and then we go out and we sort of we put on our best manners, but, you know, all of us have who we are at home. And I wanted to tell that story.
Lovely. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Correspondent, it's out now. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Virginia Evans, who we've been chatting with. Virginia, thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, thanks to you, Hannah. Thanks so much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by audible.co.uk. Download one title each month, plus unlimited listening to thousands of Audible originals, podcasts and audiobooks. Just click on the Audible banner at www.tre.radio.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.